Okay, so we got 700 billion plus 25 billion plus 600 billion. 200 billion is a loan, so...
You can't take 3 from 2. 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the tens place. Now that's really 4 tens, so you make it 3 tens, regroup, and you change the 10 to 10 ones, and you add them to the 2 and get 12, and you take away 3, that's 9. Is that clear?
The new math of the Treasury bailout. Does it add up? With all this debt, what gets subtracted from the economy? Are we clear? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, November 26th. Adora Udoji is away, starting her holiday weekend. There may be no consensus on what's going on in the bailout, but there is a consensus around the world on how to deal with climate change. And we're going to talk about the 300,000 veterans coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq with PTSD. That and plenty more. But first, your top headlines. There's extra security around Iraq's parliament today, with lawmakers set to vote on the future of American troops there. If legislators approve a security agreement, there will be a three-year time limit on the American troop presence. A key concession made to Sunni leaders appears to have the pact headed for passage. This Thanksgiving, why not gorge yourself on credit? The government won't mind.
This lack of affordable consumer credit undermines consumer spending and, as a result, weakens our economy.
Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson announcing a plan to ease consumer lending. The government's putting hundreds of billions of dollars out there to stoke the economy through consumer lending, and they're helping out companies that issue credit cards, car loans, and student loans. Also, mortgages will be affected. Femi Oke is here. What else have we got going here?
President-elect Barack Obama now has a budget director, Peter Orszag. He introduced his new pick as a man with a mission to sniff out and slice up pork barrel spending.
Just because a program, a special interest tax break, or corporate subsidy is hidden in this year's budget does not mean that it will survive the next.
Wall Street traders seemed optimistic yesterday. The Dow and S&P both finished up Tuesday, but the gains were smaller than recent rallies. European markets have been down today. Thousands of tourists are stranded in Bangkok as anti-government protesters have taken over the airport, forcing flight cancellations. Thais have been protesting their government for some time, but this frustrated American tourist. He was not involved in the protests.
Tomorrow is a real big holiday in the States. And many people will miss it because of some cockamamie little protest that you've got going.
I haven't heard cockamamie for quite a while. I like that phrase. A little takeaway travel tip for you there. It's never a good idea to insult a horde of angry protesters. We'll be following that protest through the news this morning.
I don't think that poor passenger is going to help himself out with that kind of talk. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
You're going to be thinking a lot about leftovers over the next few days if you're not stranded at the Bangkok airport.
The one Thanksgiving dish I would remove from the room before it even got there would be something called Nebraska ambrosia, which is green cabbage, 2 cups of mayonnaise, and mini marshmallows. Just the thought of it alone is enough to send your neighborhood running away in panic. I think it's the passive-aggressive dish.
I love this. What is the one holiday food you would throw out before it even makes it to the holiday table? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I have to write that down. Nebraska ambrosia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We were poking fun at Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson there at the top of the hour because he said yesterday he would do whatever it takes to lift the economy, even approve an additional $800 billion into new lending programs. This latest rescue move is the first time both the Treasury and the Federal Reserve have teamed up to lend a helping hand to consumer debt, offering aid to help with student loans, car loans, or even small business loans. Your government, that's right, is sounding more and more like a bank every single day. Joining us now to discuss the implications of this is Michael Hughes, formerly Chief Investment Officer at Baring Asset Management, an independent investment consultant. Now he joins us from Washington. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
I'm trying to get the numbers straight here, and I don't want to use the word printing press yet, but by my calculation, it seems as though in the last 12 months, the government has assumed about $7.8 trillion in financial obligations of one kind or another, and that's a huge number compared to the size of the U.S. economy. What does that mean?
Well, it's two things, really. It's almost taken that amount of money to get the mortgage rates and consumer interest rates down. And that actually does appear to have happened in the last 24 hours, more so in the last 24 hours possibly than in the previous weeks. Having said that, it's not so convincing that just reducing interest rates will get people to go out and spend again. So what he's really doing is trying to unblock the plumbing within the banking industry and hope that that would lead to more confidence in Main Street. Not so sure about the latter.
Well, confidence is the issue. I mean, have we possibly passed the psychological trigger there where people, if they get money or get the opportunity to borrow, just aren't going to do it because they don't feel confident, as you say, that they should be doing this sort of thing right now?
I think that's absolutely right. But what they're doing is actually building on the example from Japan some 10 years or more than that, actually 18 years ago now, where Japan did what's called quantitative easing, basically throwing money at the system, having already reduced interest rates in the hope that that will give some degree of stability. Well, it gave them stability, but they didn't do anything for 10 years. They just went sideways. And I think the danger here is that we need a fiscal stimulus, and arguably the new administration is looking to have one, that will make the difference, because monetary policy is just there to stabilize a very unstable situation. It isn't necessarily the right way of getting confidence back in the game.
I'm trying to get a handle on, you know, what the sort of historical implications are. You referred to Japan a moment ago. There's been a lot of comparisons to what's going on here as what preceded the Great Depression. I'm wondering if this kind of borrowing, this level of borrowing, I mean, the U.S. economy is about $16 trillion, and if we're obligated to the tune of $7.8 trillion, this begins to look like Germany in the 20s, just printing money until hyperinflation, you know, takes the government down. I mean, am I out of my mind here?
Not necessarily. Actually, the big difference with 1929 is that all the debts then were private sector debt. There were companies and individuals. And you certainly had deleveraging. In fact, three quarters of that debt was reduced within 3 years, mainly because people went bankrupt. The big thing that's different now is that the private debts are actually bigger than they were back in 29. But this time around, the public sector, the government, is prepared to take some of that private debt and put it on its own balance sheet. Now, that is unprecedented.
Right. Well, Michael Hughes, then, as a consumer, okay, thinking about, you know, Christmas lists and all of that, does what happened yesterday mean that I can go down to Neiman Marcus or Target or Walmart and, you know, suddenly pull the plastic card out of my wallet and have the credit line be doubled or tripled or extended or eased in any way?
I don't think you're going to get the limits increased very easily. But what you may find is that the terms under which you are maintaining your existing loans might be somewhat better. In other words, the interest rates might start coming down.
Well, let's sort of deconstruct it for the consumer. Michael Hughes, thank you very much for joining us. He's formerly Chief Investment Officer at Baring Asset Management, an independent investment consultant, on the line from Washington, D.C. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
Well, to give us a sense of what's going on in the mid-level, from the bankers who are actually getting the money from the back door and being told to lend it out the front door, joining us now is Mike Menzies, who's president and CEO of Easton Bank and Trust in Easton, Maryland. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, John. Good to be with you.
Now, I just wanted, I've been yearning to do this for weeks, but I really wanted to talk to somebody who's in this kind of traffic cop position between the money coming in from the Fed, and I know you're not precisely in this situation, but you're a banker, you know what this is all about, and is being encouraged to now take that money and lend it out. It appears so far that despite what the Fed has done and the Treasury have done with supplying money to the credit markets, the lending has not started yet.
What's your view of how this definitely works when money is being supplied on the back door and you're being encouraged to lend it out the front door?
Well, John, this program that was most recently announced is a program that provides liquidity to community banks. It's really not described as the Fed taking a wheelbarrow and dumping money in the bank. What's going on is that there's a market that's securitized assets of credit cards, student loans, car loans, and SBA loans, which are really important to community banks, where we can write those loans, and the Federal Reserve will buy those loans from aggregators. There are aggregators who purchase loans from community banks all around the country.
The simple question for me is, because of what Henry Paulson did yesterday, who do you say yes to on, say, a student loan or a car loan or some consumer loan that you wouldn't have said yes to had the Treasury not done that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, and I don't know that I'm going to be able to tell you that we're going to say yes to a bunch of people differently, because community banks still have relationships to underwrite loans, determine that there's income to repay the loans, and they're still saying yes and have been saying yes from the get-go. Community banks really haven't locked up their lending and locked up their credit.
No, and we've talked to community banks. Actually, the credit is pretty healthy down at the community bank level. But just put the hat of a more regional bank on and describe to me what the predicament is for a larger bank that's maybe a little, you know, once removed from the community level. What's their resistance or hesitation?
Well, see, their resistance is that many of those banks are basically brokering loans. They're writing loans and selling them into the market, and a large volume of loans are actually brokered. They're securitized. And the marketplace has stopped buying those pools of loans. It's constipated.
So as a banker, let me just get this really precise here. So as a banker, okay, if you're writing loans and you can't sell them the next day, you're not going to write anymore. You're basically taking the open for business sign down a little bit.
If you're a large bank and you depend upon the securitized market for your liquidity and you depend upon being able to sell those loans in order to write loans, you're right. It'll lock down. And that's what happened with SBA loans in October. And SBA loans are really important. They're a third of the capital that goes into small businesses. And if you can't sell the SBA loans, whether you're a big or a small bank, that constipates the system, that slows down credit. This particular move from yesterday will, in fact, over time, help provide some liquidity to small business loans, car loans, student loans, and the like. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to cause lenders to say, come in, I'm going to throw the money at you because the government's giving it to us and we don't need to underwrite it. That's not going to happen, but it will provide liquidity to these markets.
And mortgage rates took a really steep dive yesterday, which is a very interesting story. There was another interesting story out of the FDIC, and I want to get your banker perspective. The FDIC reported that the number of troubled banks, watch banks, banks that it's really concerned about, maybe going under, doubled yesterday, and the mm-hmm. number was something on the order of 174, something like that. How concerned are you in a time when this number is rising that banks are going to feel secure enough to actually do the kind of lending that the Treasury says needs to happen?
Well, remember, John, there are over 8,000, I'll repeat that number, there are over 8,000 community banks in this nation that are somewhere around or below $10 billion in size. So, yeah, 100 or 200 community banks or 200 banks in general, that's a big number and that's worrisome, but there are lots and lots of community banks around this nation, and they're not all going under. The lion's share of them, like Eastern Bank and Trust and many other members of our trade association, the Independent Community Bankers of America, are solid as a rock, and they're still making loans, they're still getting deposits, they're healthy, they're doing well. The banks that are in stress are those in markets where their real estate has tanked because of over liquefying those markets and too much liquidity going into real estate. So they're struggling. But this is not 5 or 10% of the banks in the nation. It's a very small percentage.
Well, it's nice to get the perspective of someone who is a banker, who sort of sees it from the back door and the front door. Mike Menzies is the president and CEO of Easton Bank and Trust in Easton, Maryland. Thanks so much, Mike.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello, this is Cynthia, and I'm working out of Needham right now. And I just wanted to let you know that the dish that I would throw away before it even made it to the Thanksgiving dinner table would be creamed onions. Whoever thought of such a thing? Yucky creamed onions.
Let's face it, there's one holiday food you would throw out before it makes it to the table. Tell us what it is, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Wouldn't change a thing about you.
That's right. The other big story this morning is no change at the Pentagon. Apparently, Robert Gates will stay on in his post as Secretary of Defense when Barack Obama takes office as president, at least for the first year of the administration. Mr. Gates, former CIA chief, was appointed Defense Secretary 2 years ago. And for more on this, Rob Watson joins us, BBC defense correspondent. He's in London. Rob, good morning.
Good morning, John.
What do you think the worldview is of Gates staying on, given there's been so much criticism worldwide of U.S. foreign policy and particularly the military intervention in Iraq?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by the world. I guess if there was an international opinion poll, maybe it wouldn't go down that brilliantly. But I think if you mean more strictly other defense ministers around the world, other militaries around the world, those involved in what might be broadly called the Western coalition, within which one includes NATO, of course, I think it'll be pretty broadly welcomed. He is hugely respected. He's credited with really having steadied the Pentagon, and he's regarded as a man that you can really do business with.
Now, is this sort of a backhanded reveal that, in fact, the security establishment has been thinking beyond George W. Bush for quite a while, including in the offices of NATO, and that Gates staying on has very little to do with continuity with Bush and much more to do with turning a page?
Well, I guess what Mr. Gates would probably argue is that, he'd never been a particular cheerleader for the war in Iraq, which, of course, is the most controversial aspect of U.S. foreign policy of the last two Bush administrations. So I guess he wouldn't perhaps quite see it that way. Look, I think it's a number of things. I think it's certainly a feeling in the Obama transition team that continuity was needed, that after all, you've got the United States still engaged in two massive operations, no two ways about it, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and more broadly, the war against terrorism. So you have that. You have a certain amount of continuity. But I think that more broadly speaking, it shows that the United States shows that the Obama transition team has a very pragmatic approach.
But could that pragmatism also be viewed as a sense that maybe the new president isn't really driving the policy, and that there's an enormous sort of global momentum with NATO, the war on terror, the very battlefields you describe, that no single president is in a position to steer one way or another?
No, I don't think that the Obama transition team or the incoming president would accept that for one little minute. I mean, I think they would argue very strongly that they will be in charge. It's just that why change the man, certainly in the short term, who represents continuity, who represents stability, and who is so well respected, not just in the United States, but outside. So I think they would say, look, we are still in charge. It's just that we don't see any particular need to change the man right at the very top. He is, after all, a servant of the elected president.
Now, on some level, defense ministers around Europe particularly, and even in the UK, have had to deal with a probably annoying lack of continuity as administration transitions from one to the other, with, you know, task forces taking a look at the Pentagon policy, at military policy, and things sort of changing every 4 years, every 8 years. In some ways, this might be a relief to what has been, in the past, a lot of upheaval in defense policy. Do you think so?
Well, I think, again, it depends on what level. And on a sort of, you know, the men in uniform kind of level, that they're used to dealing with each other in the alliance. They have in the past, they will today, and they will in the future. So it's not so much of a problem there. But yes, at a political level, in terms of the who is the civilian face of U.S. defense policy, certainly it will no doubt make a welcome change. I guess I should add that for many European, in particular NATO defense ministers, they will certainly be very familiar with Robert Gates and his performances at NATO summits, where he often pleads and cajoles with other NATO members to send more troops to Afghanistan. And I guess some of them will be grinning to themselves today, saying, well, I guess we can expect a bit more of the same.
More bleeding. Finally, the fact that he comes from the security establishment, from the CIA, how does that have an impact on his role in interfacing with the militaries in NATO and around the world?
Well, I guess it just all of it adds to his status as what might be seen as probably one of America's better public servants over the last 10, 20 years. There's no doubt that he is respected by defense and security officials in Europe and NATO countries. There's absolutely no doubt about it. There was certainly a kind of almost a sigh of relief, I think, when he was appointed to take over from Donald Rumsfeld 2 years ago. And he's made a lot of friends, even though there's no doubt that some of the messages he's often taken to NATO meetings haven't always been the ones that NATO defense ministers have wanted to hear. But I think he is regarded as being very steady. And I think what I will remember in particular, and maybe a lot of other people who were there will remember, is his extraordinary calmness in dealing with President Putin's outspoken outburst at a security conference a year ago.
Well, Rob Rotson, the headline is we are in the post-Rumsfeld era. I guess the thing to watch is, will Gates' cajoling be more effective in getting troops into Afghanistan as Robert Gates takes the helm here? Rob Watson, thanks for joining us, BBC defense correspondent. He joined us from London at our partner, the BBC's Bush House there in London. And Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. It's the holiday season and the Bush administration wants to make sure you have some money in your pocket. The Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, announced a plan yesterday to put hundreds of billions towards the credit cards, car loans and student loans. The Wednesday before Thanksgiving is usually the busiest travel day of the year, but AAA says that they're expecting about 400,000 fewer travellers this year. That's a 1.5% drop from last year. The South African government could have prevented hundreds of thousands of AIDS-related deaths since 2000 if they'd provided antiretroviral drugs. That's according to a new study by Harvard researchers. Former President Thabo Mbeki refused to acknowledge scientific research about the viral cause of AIDS. Jamaica's parliament has voted to keep the death penalty. The country hasn't had an execution in 20 years, but the country's high murder rate motivated that decision. There have been more than 1,200 murders there in this year in that very small island nation. Now, who's ever heard of bankers turning down a massive compensation deal? Well, it's happening in Switzerland, and that's according to our partners at the New York Times. Three former executives at the financial giant UBS in Switzerland have turned down $27 million in compensation. The execs were promised the package despite the Swiss bank reporting $50 billion in losses. And in a press statement they issued, the executive said that not taking the compensation should not be considered an admission of guilt.
You'd probably take the money, wouldn't you?
I would take the money.
You would take the money,
yeah.
Yes. Right,
I have no shame.
Any news on the Iraq vote on the status of forces agreement?
Still waiting to hear about that. Yeah, right. I will bring that to you when we get it.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Of course, the U.S. election was all about change this November. But how do you measure change on an issue that's global in scale and with a population that's global in scale? Well, climate change is certainly one of those global issues, and it does appear that a major consensus is emerging that the serious change should take place regarding the environment. People would be willing to tolerate actual changes in lifestyle and sacrifices by their own governments to arrest global warming. Joining us to talk about what appears to be a global consensus on real sacrifice and real change for global climate is BBC Environment correspondent who joined us from London. Richard, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, John. Nice to be with you.
Yes. First of all, how is this survey and sample taken, and what do you think the marching orders are from what appears to be a fairly strong consensus here?
Yeah, sure. The poll involved about 12,000 people in 11 countries and one territory. That's the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region. It was commissioned by the HSBC Climate Partnership, which is an agency run by the bank, organized by the bank, but involves several environment groups and other business groups as well. And they asked a range of questions. And I suppose that one of the top line figures they produced was that almost a half of the people they questioned would like their governments to be taking a strong lead on climate change, but only about a quarter of those questioned actually felt that their governments were taking a strong lead.
So it's an impatience with government and a sense that they could do more, that the sacrifices that are at least on the horizon are something that they might actually embrace to produce change. Let me play for you Rupert Posner, who's the director of the Australian section of the Climate Group, which is one of the organizations that commissioned this study, talking about the emerging markets. And I want to set it up by just saying we're told in the sort of media consuming public that emerging markets like China and Brazil actually feel as though pollution controls and carbon quotas restrain them in their growth. But in fact, the survey found just the opposite.
Something that surprised me a little bit is how strongly people from countries such as China and India want strong action in their own countries, and that they believe it is appropriate for their countries to cut their emissions by their fair share. It's also kind of interesting to see that people in China think that they should do their own fair share, but that it's reasonable for the Indians to do a little bit less. And it actually is the vice versa as well. The Indians think they should do their fair share, but understand why perhaps the Chinese might not do quite as much.
You know, that's fascinating, Richard, because there's not the sense of bickering and intransigence that you hear from world leaders on this subject when there's a summit on climate change.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And if you look at the people's responses to the question, would you be prepared to make changes to your lifestyle to help reduce climate change? In fact, you find that there's a stronger yes to that in the developing countries. So in this particular poll, Mexico, Brazil, India, Malaysia, people, more than half of people were saying, yes, I would be willing to make those changes. China, it was almost half. Of the developed countries polled, Only the French were anywhere near as enthusiastic for that.
Really? What does that say?
I'm not sure. We have to play around a little bit and be slightly speculative. You could hypothesize that people in countries like Germany, for example, where there's an awful lot of awareness of climate change issues, know more about the type of sacrifices they might have to make, the type of changes that would be required to restrain their emissions.
We could just say, Richard, that the French are just kind of impossibly hip, and this is just another example of them being out on the head of global culture.
Yes, it's that famous Parisian left bank spirit all over again.
Sarkozy thing, you know. But let's tee this up with sort of the last question, and that is, can governments take advantage of this consensus in any practical way? Do you see that?
In a practical way, I'm not sure, but I think governments that want to push for strong action can certainly make some symbolic use of it. They can argue that this poll, and it's not the only one. I mean, the BBC commissioned a poll in, I think, 21 countries a year ago that produced similar results. They can argue that this does constitute a global mandate, that citizens out there are calling for action. And one very important point was that over 40% of the people polled said that climate change was a more pressing issue than the global financial crisis. And if you look at the amount of resources and attention and so on that politicians are putting into that, well, here's an indication that a significant proportion of the world's population would actually like similar attention to climate change.
Well, fascinating stuff. Richard Black, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Richard Black is the BBC Environment correspondent. He was talking to us about a remarkable global consensus on changing lifestyle and making sacrifices in the pursuit of real progress on climate change. That survey had some pretty remarkable results. Femi Yoke is here with the headlines. We got some economic news right at the top, it looks like.
Yeah, we do, absolutely. The time is just coming up to 23 minutes to the top of the hour. So orders to US factories for durable goods plunged by 6.2%, and that's the biggest decline in 2 years. Other economic data we also have, the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits fell to 529,000. That's more than analysts expected, down from last week's 16-year high. And consumer spending fell by 1% in October, and that's the largest drop since the terrorist attacks of 2001.
Yeah, that's an important number. The Wall Street futures, NASDAQ, S&P, and Dow are all down, but they haven't moved that much since those numbers came out.
Right. Okay. We'll see how they do in about 40 minutes' time from now when the markets open. The European Union is putting a lot of money, and they want to stimulate their economy. It's launching a $250 billion plan. It will unfold over 2 years. The funds will come from member countries and the EU's own stash of funds. More than 300 people have died in a cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe. This comes from the World Health Organization. The WHO says the situation is likely to worsen because of poor sanitation and a lack of clean drinking water. The WHO has also announced a new study on HIV. They say the virus could theoretically be eliminated within a decade if people living in countries with high infection rates are regularly tested and treated. The model is based on data from testing in Africa. HIV infections dropped by 95% in communities where people were routinely tested. Big thunderstorms are expected today in California, and that's going to be a problem. Burned areas in Santa Barbara County are especially vulnerable to flooding and landslides, and county officials have asked residents to evacuate. Santa Barbara Fire Captain Eli Isco wants people out.
We're advising people that live in the immediate burn area and immediately below, which would be those drainages right below the area, to leave the area.
Thousands of homes there are under evacuation orders. Really, what you could do not with. Not
right.
Do with. Let me just reorganize those words into a sentence. Just the day before Thanksgiving. John.
The Associated Press is just reporting, and it's not like you missed this or anything. It happened just a moment ago. Iraqi Parliament Speaker says the vote on the security pact, that so-called status of forces agreement with the U.S., will be delayed now until Thursday. So that will be a big story we'll be covering tomorrow.
And Parliament sort of sat about 2 hours ago, and they hadn't even sat down to discuss this.
Yeah, well, they have a different sense of urgency there in Iraq. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we are talking about the English language and holiday food this morning.
Yeah, my name's Jerry. I'm in New Jersey, and my pet peeve is the word merkin. I don't want to be a merkin. I prefer to be an American from now on.
Ooh, that's splitting hairs. No more merkins. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Keep them coming, folks.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Adora Udoji is away. There are now over 800,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, and of those 300,000 have been diagnosed with PTSD. That's half of these veterans have had professional help, and there are now over 800,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And PTSD is a significant health problem. And here to talk about interesting technology that's being used to treat it and the sort of broad sense of how long we're going to be dealing with the implications of that many people with PTSD coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan is Dr. Michael Kramer, a clinical psychologist at the Veterans Administration Hospital right here in Manhattan. He's here in the studio. Thanks for coming in, Michael Kramer.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, you know, you're using some novel techniques to try to treat people with PTSD. And remind people, what does that acronym stand for again?
VRET is the acronym Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's from battlefield experiences that resonate long after the actual experience.
It could be combat experiences. It's not limited to only combat experiences, but to traumatic experiences, generally speaking. But we treat combat veterans at the VA.
And the second acronym that you tantalizingly mentioned there?
VRET stands for virtual reality exposure therapy, and I believe that's probably the new technology you were referring to
in
the introduction.
In fact, virtual reality means that you allow people to remain as a kind of a digital halfway house in their combat situation to wean them away from the violence or to revisit it in some way? Explain how the technology works.
It's primarily to revisit it with the goal of helping combat veterans, in this particular case, learn to process, deal with, and basically move on from the traumatic experiences that they may have had in combat.
What impact does it have that traditional therapies don't?
Actually, at base, it is a traditional therapy. Exposure therapy for PTSD has been around for some time now and has been considered the standard treatment for post-traumatic stress for quite some time.
But it's more talk-based.
Well, this is, yes. The kind of exposure therapies that we were using previously before virtual reality were all talk-based. We would ask the trauma survivor to use their imagination and their memory to go back and revisit a particular trauma that they may have been through in great detail, with the goal being the more they can face it, the more they can learn how to adjust and adapt to the anxiety and distress that comes with those memories, the more they'd be able to move past those memories and not have them be so affecting in their life.
Now, does virtual reality therapy reduce the time it takes for those soldiers to actually be comfortable going back in some way?
Going back to
revisit the experience that is producing the PTSD. In other words, does it make it easier for them to revisit or let you know it remove some sort of obstacle?
Yes, it does for some. It's a high technology therapy, and we found, as we hoped we would find, that some of the younger vets, some of the younger returning Iraq and Afghanistan vets, who are more familiar with that kind of technology and computer monitors and the like are more comfortable for them.
I mean, combat soldiers are very familiar with simulation, either in training or just their own gaming and digital gadgets that they bring with them to the battlefield.
That is definitely true, more true for the younger vets. Remember, we have a lot of older vets and older Reserve and National Guard members that are going into combat in this particular conflict. And for some of them, the technology is still a little foreign to them.
Well, aside from the technology, the scale of the PTSD problem as a health matter that we're going to be dealing with for quite a while is something I want to discuss with you. Stay with us. Dr. Michael Kramer is a clinical psychologist at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Manhattan. We're talking about technological solutions to PTSD and the broad epidemiological implications of 800,000 soldiers diagnosed potentially.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. With us is Dr. Michael Kramer, a clinical psychologist at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Manhattan, who oversaw the introduction of Virtual Iraq. It's a virtual reality tool for treating PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, let me remind you that 300,000 soldiers of the 800,000 Iraq and Afghanistan returning veterans have been diagnosed with PTSD. Michael Kramer, how big a number is that, 300,000 with PTSD?
That's a big number. It's not a completely surprising number, but it's a big number.
And only half of these veterans have had professional help. What does that mean?
It means many things. It means it's difficult for vets to come in and ask for help. It means that some that choose to come in for help have a difficult time navigating the system. It means that the system itself takes some time to gear up for the influx of the returning veterans, which I think the VA happens to be doing a very good job of. But it's hard to keep track with all of those numbers. And it's also hard to keep track with those numbers in the context of so many of these Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are doing multiple tours.
Right.
And so you will have people returning from a combat zone with problems such as post-traumatic stress who are under the gun of potentially going back. And how you treat post-traumatic stress disorders in that context changes the game a little bit also.
You know, and what's interesting to me is that this is a much more complex problem and a much larger scale problem than the big scandal at Walter Reed, where they found, veterans weren't getting the right treatment and facilities were sort of disgusting and in a state of disrepair. I mean, in many ways, as significant as that was, this may be way more significant.
Yeah, I would agree.
really. Let's talk about the nature of the injuries. I mean, PTSD is sort of the beginning of the chain of cognitive and mental illnesses that maybe come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, which can range everything from, you know, PTSD in its standard form to blast injuries that have a strange sort of cognitive problems for people that are very, very difficult to measure, all the way to traumatic brain injury, where you do have people with serious skull fractures and right. major permanent disabilities. How difficult is it for you to isolate PTSD from some of these other things?
It's difficult at times. PTSD in a combat situation sometimes by definition comes with some sort of blast, some sort of brain injury. So the symptoms oftentimes mirror each other. And so it's not always easy to separate it out. You do, well, at the VA now we're doing thorough traumatic brain injury evaluations for any veteran who answers questions that may indicate they were in any kind of situation where they could have suffered head injury.
And so that represents a change. That wasn't done at the very beginning. That really sort of came as you began to see these numbers increase.
That's exactly right. One of the consequences of modern warfare is that more people survive. Because of equipment, et cetera, which is, of course, a good thing. But one of the consequences is more right. people come home with significant
exactly.
injuries, injuries that they may not have made it back from the battlefield for previously.
So the VA has to be a large-scale sort of health facility to deal with the thousands and thousands of people with these kinds of problems. But it also has to be a research facility because for this very reason you described, you're on the cutting edge of research into disorders that we don't fully understand.
This is true. That's been the traditional role of the VA. The VA played a significant role in many ways with the development of the field of clinical psychology using veterans coming back from World War II. It unfortunately presents an opportunity for places like the VA to do research and find more cutting-edge treatments for these kinds of conditions because this is what we see coming out of war.
Well, speaking of cutting-edge, virtual reality. Describe a situation, a breakthrough, a moment that really sticks out in your mind as a young soldier dealing with some very serious issues, straps themselves into your virtual reality system mm-hmm. and goes from playing a video game to having a very important sort of personal moment reflecting on a battle that happened long ago.
Sure. Virtual Iraq is the program we're primarily using for the Iraq veterans, and there are two different scenarios that we could place the veteran in using this equipment, and one is a convoy Humvee kind of scenario, which
right.
just about any Iraq combat veteran would be familiar with. It's the entry into the country, so anyone going into Iraq has been in that kind of scenario. Some veterans have been more in street combat operation scenario. So we have another scenario that covers those kinds of scenes and sounds and smells, and we can recreate those situations to match
the
experience
of the veteran. And the vets respond to that matching. They go, whoa, this is real.
Sometimes they go, whoa, this is real. That's absolutely right. Very rarely do veterans get caught up in believing they are actually back in Iraq in the sense of a flashback kind of experience
right.
where they get fooled into thinking we are back in Iraq. It's pretty clear that you're in a therapy situation, and as much as we try to present stimuli that will really evoke what the original traumatic experience was like, it still remains a therapeutic experience and one where the vets feel, you know, for the most part, pretty confident that they're safe. But that said, it's pretty sophisticated equipment, and we can recreate a lot of visual scenes, certainly a lot of auditory scenes, the sounds of gunfire, the sounds of explosions, which were digitally recreated from the actual weapons.
Any soldiers give you the impression they want to stay there?
To stay in Iraq?
In the virtual reality?
Very rarely.
Very rarely.
Very rarely. It's a very challenging treatment. It's designed in some ways to raise distress levels.
Right.
It's designed to do it in a controlled therapeutic way so that the trauma survivor can feel that they can manage the strong emotions that come with the memories. And that's really the point of the treatment, is to help them learn that they can overcome the emotional experience that comes with the memory and the reminders.
On the cutting edge there, Dr. Michael Kramer is a clinical psychologist at the Veterans Administration Hospital here in Manhattan, dealing with virtual reality as a tool for helping the 300,000 estimated Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who have been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines before we go.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 5 minutes to the top of the hour. Iraq's parliament speaker says the vote on the security pact with the US will be delayed until Thursday. Now, if legislators approve a security agreement, it puts a three-year time limit on the American troop presence. A deal to put the pact to a national referendum next year appears to have some increasing support from Sunni leaders skeptical of the security agreement. The number of people who applied for unemployment benefits fell to 529,000. That's more than analysts expected, down from last week's 16-year high. And consumer spending fell by 1% in October, and that's the largest drop since the terrorist attacks of 2001. Traces of the toxic chemical melamine are showing up in American baby formula. The FDA says that it has found low levels of melamine in popular formula brands. They say the formula is still safe. Scientists blame the Chinese formula with much higher concentrations of melamine for sickening tens of thousands of babies, and that was earlier this year. The government of Zimbabwe has rejected calls to declare a state of emergency over a cholera outbreak, saying that it is under control. The UN says that more than 360 people have died there so far from cholera since August. And the outbreak is being monitored by the World Health Organization. They say it's likely to worsen because of poor sanitation and a lack of clean drinking water. The former First Lady, Barbara Bush, is in the hospital. She was admitted last night in Houston after complaining of stomach pain for the past few days. A spokesman for the Bush family says that it was just a precaution and she's now doing well. Barbara Bush is 83 years old.
Oh, you've made her weekend. Announcing that to everyone. Yes. I'm sure she loves that.
I'm sure she'll be home for the turkey, hopefully.
Any other Thanksgiving story?
Oh, terrible Thanksgiving travel story. Now, you're just about to fly home. Imagine this. Your trip from Thailand has been a great trip. You're at the airport. Suddenly, you're surrounded by protesters. And American traveler Eric Jacobson is doing his best to talk his way home.
Have you any idea of the tens of thousands of people whose plans you have screwed up?
We really apologize for that, sir. We do not intend to make you unhappy because we are a smile country.
Okay, don't want to make you unhappy. We're a small country. But protesters surrounding the Bangkok airport are not letting people out. Thousands of travellers are actually stranded. Looks like they're going to be there all the way through Thanksgiving as well. The Thai army has asked the protesters to go home. They're not going anywhere.
It's a standoff. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we're still hearing for you on words that you hate.
Hi, this is Catherine Myers from Bloomfield, New Jersey, and I really can't stand this phrase. I want to pick your brain, because if you picture that, it's just disgusting.
You can hear her child agonizing over that phrase there in the background. And, you know, suddenly I'm a target here, folks.
This is Dominic. I'm calling from New York. I think the overused phrase or word is bellwether. Maybe you should just, you know, maybe have a quota for bellwether or use it only once a week. I hear it all the time on the takeaway. I love you guys. Bye.
Okay, shifting over to canary in the coal mine. What's the one holiday food you would throw out before it even makes it to the table? That's our other question this morning. Candied yams, cranberries, pumpkin pie. Mark Horowitz wrote us an email to say sweet potatoes with mini marshmallows, anything with mayonnaise, anything with ketchup. What about this?
Hi, my name is Gerard. I'm calling from planet Earth. What would I throw out before Thanksgiving dinner? My in-laws.
We're always on at The Takeaway. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your holiday food suggestion or repulsion. This is John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
So, planning on flying this holiday weekend?
I don't want to die. I don't want to die. Oh, Aunt, don't let me die, my babies. Aunt.
Give two of these when you can. They'll quiet.
Okay, it's not that bad. The airlines were the scourge of the travel industry last summer, but reduced traffic, fuel prices, and passengers may have improved things. But for how long? A transportation policy for the high and the mighty. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, November 26th. Dodora Udoji is away. Unfortunately, she's not in Thailand, where there is no happy travel stories there. We'll tell you about that in a moment. But we're also talking about sponsorship in sports. It looks like recession-proof is not something the sports world can count on this time. And the Thanksgiving flying, it's going to be rough, but transportation policy is to the rescue. That and more, but first, your top headlines. Iraq's parliament now says it will wait until tomorrow to vote on the future of American troops in that country. If legislators approve a security agreement, so-called status of forces agreement, it puts a three-year time limit on the American troop presence. Lawmakers were supposed to vote earlier today. Wall Street closes tomorrow to mark a gluttonous holiday. It means several servings of key economic data are getting dished out this morning. Some good in there. Jobless claims dropped more than economists expected, but consumer spending fell by a full 1%, the largest drop in 7 years. Durable goods orders went down by more than 6%. That number basically tells us that factories are a lot less busy making stuff like cars and appliances. Traders will diagnose all that before Wall Street opens in under a half an hour. Futures trading point to a lower opening, although the numbers didn't really push the needle that much. President-elect Barack Obama holds a news conference on the economy a little over an hour from now. He's widely expected to name former Fed Chair Paul Volcker to head a special emergency economic advisory panel. And what am I missing here, Femi, okay, with the other headlines?
Hi there, John. Well, President Bush still has the White House, and his team is spending hundreds of billions to stoke consumer spending. But Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson says it won't change things overnight.
The fact is we now have the tools and the capacity to stabilize the system and work to get credit flowing again, and it will take a while to do that.
The government's putting big money out there to help companies that issue credit cards, car loans, and student loans. Wall Street traders seemed optimistic about something yesterday. The Dow and S&P both finished up Tuesday, but the gains were smaller than recent rallies. European markets have been down today. Holiday traffic may not be too bad today. AAA says they're expecting about 400,000 fewer cars on the road. This even as average gas prices have dipped below $2 a gallon. And that's a departure from last year when Thanksgiving travel reached a record high.
And fuel prices were higher as well. Thank you, Femi. So I'm sure you're going to be thinking about leftovers in the next few days if you're not having travel woes.
In my family, the one holiday food that we serve at every meal is meat stuffing, which I never had until I was married, and I would gladly throw it out if it didn't alienate half my family. But the idea of putting ground meat inside a raw turkey, it just turns my stomach.
Okay, tell us the one holiday food you would throw out before it even makes it to the table. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. On some level, it may sound contradictory, but after running on a message of change, President-elect Barack Obama apparently is not going to change the chief of the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense. It seems pretty clear that Defense Secretary Robert Gates is not going anywhere after an election campaign that was all about changes in Iraq and particularly changes in U.S. defense policy. For the first time, a Pentagon commander will be asked to keep his post between presidents of two different parties, at least for a year or so. Joining us now is Peter Baker from our partner, the New York Times, in the Washington Bureau. Peter, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I want to just sort of track, first of all, the level of unprecedentedness of this. I mean, certainly there are two battlefields active right now, Afghanistan and Iraq. There's certainly an argument for continuity in the Pentagon. But politically, how unusual is this?
Well, it's pretty unusual. I mean, you know, Lyndon Johnson kept Robert McNamara when he took over from after John Kennedy's assassination, and Gerald Ford kept Richard Nixon's Defense Secretary Schlesinger. But those are presidents of the same party. This is the first time you had a Democrat keep or a Republican's Defense Secretary, or the other way around.
And even during a time of war, you know, a president usually brings his own person in to run the Pentagon. In this case, though, Barack Obama decided that some sense of bipartisan continuity was more important, and Robert Gates will be a symbol for the country of a unified government. That's the idea, anyway.
Well, the idea could also be that there's a kind of a scale of the Pentagon bureaucracy and the national security establishment, and let's include the defense ministers of NATO and all of the sort of places that the U.S. is around the world. That's just too big for one president to try to turn. Turning the aircraft carrier comes to mind here, that actually has a momentum that defies an individual president to actually do anything about. How does the Obama administration combat that idea?
Well, I mean, that's certainly true, obviously. And when President-elect Obama takes office in a couple months, you know, his first priority is going to be the economy. So, you know, in some ways, you could look at this as, in a sense, deferring any significant changes at the Pentagon until he's got the economy more fully in gear and he can turn his full attention to that. You know, Robert Gates is well respected by people in both parties. He's been a pragmatist. He's somebody who is seen as not a particularly ideological figure. Coming after Don Rumsfeld, he was seen as a relief both to members of the military and to people on Capitol Hill. But, you know, the other side of this, of course, is a lot of people who voted and supported Barack Obama, particularly from the beginning, thought they were voting for somebody who was against the Iraq War and it was going to bring dramatic change, you know, in terms of the country's military policies. And there's something sort of jarring about keeping the guy who's been running the Iraq War for the last 2 years.
You know, one of the legacies of the Bush administration is that the Secretary of Defense status, you know, increased or profile increased significantly. And it could be argued that the Secretary of State, as the kind of diplomatic international policy front face of the U.S. government, diminished significantly. Does this carry that forward, or is it a sign that maybe the Obama administration would rather have a stronger Secretary of State going forward?
Well, I think, you know, if you have Hillary Rodham Clinton as Secretary of State, as we believe she'll be appointed next week or nominated next week, I think it's hard to argue that you won't have a pretty strong Secretary of State. She's going to be a formidable figure, and it will be interesting to see how she would get along with Bob Gates' sort of partners in going forward. You know, Gates is no shrinking violet, but he's not Don Rumsfeld either, and he has not been decisive figure. He's made a lot of very strong decisions, but at the same time, he hasn't been sort of the same kind of presence that Rumsfeld was at the podium.
Two things. Robert Gates comes from the CIA, the National Security Establishment, and under Rumsfeld, so much more of the funding of the national security and espionage establishment seemed to shift into the Pentagon. Is that likely to continue here, or is that a process that is undergoing some transformation?
Well, that's an open question at this point. We do not yet know who will necessarily take over the intelligence establishment under President-elect Obama. The name we're hearing most often for Director of National Intelligence is Admiral Dennis Blair. He was a former commander of the Pacific Command and, you know, a longtime Navy veteran who recently retired. But the person we thought might be the CIA director, a man named John Brennan, 25-year veteran of the agency, pulled out yesterday because people were complaining that they thought he was too close to some of the detention and interrogation policies that have been so controversial over these last few years. He denies that. He says he was actually an opponent of them, but he pulled out saying he didn't want to be a distraction to President-elect Obama. So we don't know who's going to be the part of that team at this point.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I mean,
yeah, it really is.
It sounds like that may be the place to look for the sign of the sort of Obama change agent rather than at the head of the Pentagon in the Secretary of Defense's office. Finally, does Gates need to be reconfirmed or renominated or anything like that?
No, he doesn't. I mean, the way it works is, you know, he's already in that job, and he serves at the pleasure of the president, whichever president happens to be there. So, you know, he may go up to the Hill to testify, but he is in the job as long as this president and the next one want him to stay.
And that's the one set of confirmation hearings we don't have to sit through. Peter Baker, thanks for joining
exactly.
us. Peter Baker is a reporter for the New York Times, our partner, speaking with us from Washington, D.C., on the apparent renomination of Robert Gates to be Secretary of Defense in at least the first year of the Barack Obama administration. Joining us now is David Jimenez, a correspondent for El Mundo, who contributes to our partner, the BBC. He's on the line from Bangkok, where there is an extraordinary crisis taking place there. The head of the Thai army has told the embattled government to dissolve parliament and call new elections, but the army chief, General Angpong Pachinda, denied that he was staging a coup and said the government still had full authority. The airport is closed because protesters have stormed the airport and there are thousands of travelers stranded, and we've been hearing their voices this morning. David Jimenez, what's the situation right now in Bangkok?
Yeah, Bangkok is calm, but the main airport is still closed and dozens of flights have been canceled. There are thousands of tourists and businessmen affected, and such a daring move by the opposition could not go for long without a response. Keep in mind that Thailand is highly dependent on tourists, and we're in the beginning of the high season, so there were worries that this would damage the image of Thailand beyond repair, and the army decided to intervene.
And the protesters from the People's Alliance for Democracy have variously taken over the prime minister's office and have been calling for a coup for months now. Is there any chance that the army can actually resolve this?
Well, they are very powerful, and definitely I don't think the government, either the government or the opposition, will dare to challenge their decision. And elections will be held, and they will have to remove the people from the airport. But it doesn't solve the situation because this is, as you say, it is going on for months, and it's still a huge divide between different sections of the Thailand society. And I think this will keep going on because the last two elections didn't solve the problem. I don't think that this third one will do any different.
And the protesters and the opposition have exhibited a taste for certainly, you know, sticking with their opposition to the government, if not violence. I guess my question is, what is the chance, and we should be careful about this, but what is the chance that the passengers stranded at the airport become more like hostages in the incoming days?
Well, so far they haven't been harassed in any way, but it's true that in the last days we have seen TV footage of people shooting firearms, and we have seen grenades thrown to the crowds. And it is a high volatile situation, and anything could happen. What is amazing is that the opposition, in the latest days, the maximum people they have managed to take to the streets is 10,000. And with that amount of people, they have managed to shut down the government, take the airport, and as you say, the House of Government.
So just 10,000 people. All right. If they're not hostages, the passengers at the airport, are they at least in danger of being in the crossfire? Should the army actually move in?
Well, I don't think the army will do that. But what is true is that it is very annoying for them. You know, I have been spoken to people who were trying to fly back to the U.S. for Thanksgiving, and they could not do it. You know, so in a way, they are hostages of the situation. I don't think anybody, either the army or the opposition, will do any harm to them, or they will take hostage. But if the airport keeps closed for a few days, many of these people, they're going to have a lot of problems getting back to their families or doing their business.
Well, let's hope it stays an annoyance. David Jimenez is a correspondent for El Mundo and contributes to our partner, the BBC, talking about the stalemate at the international airport in Bangkok, Thailand.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As we're learning this week, the English language, it turns out, contains an enormous amount of reckless excess.
My favorite expression that I love to hate is, it doesn't get better than this. God help us if it doesn't get better than this.
Hopefully your dinner table tomorrow will be better than some of the holiday foods you've been telling us about this morning. We want to hear from you. What's the holiday food you would throw out before it makes it to the table? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. As we open up America's briefing book once again to take a look at issues that will be facing the president-elect, the economic crisis is probably accelerating the sense that China is of greater priority than at any other transition between administrations. Here to talk about China's effect on the global economy as well as the traditional issues we've always faced in dealing with Beijing is Liz Economy. She's the Star Senior Fellow and the Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for coming into the studio, Liz.
Thank you, John.
So Liz, it seems to me that the traditional U.S.-China bilateral issues, human rights, et cetera, are in some ways sidestepped by this tectonic shift that's taking place in the international global crisis where China appears to be, on some level, bankrolling a lot of the borrowing that's being done to restore the health of the financial sector in the United States. How does that change the U.S.-China relationship as President Obama is inaugurated?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, certainly, you know, one of the issues that has been talked about over the past few years has been the extent to which the Chinese have become holders of U.S. debt. But I think beyond that, what we've seen that as China's economy has grown, it's, you know, achieved extraordinary economic success over the past, say, 5 to 7 years, that the range of issues in which China plays now has expanded dramatically. So, you know, certainly global finance and trade is one issue. But beyond that, China is a major player in issues like global climate change, obviously food and product safety issues, proliferation issues, and even looking to conflicts in Africa or Southeast Asia or Latin America now, wherever the U.S. traditionally has been, we now see China becoming more deeply engaged. So I think the message for President Obama is that, as you suggest, China is going to have to be a major focus of our foreign policy effort looking forward.
So does that mean that Taiwan and the human rights issue and some of the labor issues that have been talked about frequently over the last 20 years go away or are diminished in some way?
I don't think that the traditional issues are simply disappear. I think Taiwan is one where I think we've managed to achieve a certain level of stability. And in fact, I think domestic issues within Taiwan suggest sort of forward momentum in the Taiwan mainland relationship, which can only be positive for the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. But I think the issue of human rights, for example, is actually fairly fundamental to many of the issues that we want to address with China. Because, if you look across the spectrum of issues, whether you're talking about food and product safety or intellectual property rights or the environment, you're talking about issues of governance at the local level in China. And can China not only sign on to international agreements, but can they adhere to these agreements? And what we found is that because of the lack of transparency, because of the lack of official accountability and the rule of law, that China is not necessarily so good at pushing forward on some of these key issues. So issues like human rights, which rely on good governance in China, I think actually do still mean quite a bit in the relationship.
Well, that raises a really interesting point, and that is that on some level, the world economy is making a big bet that China's economic stability is matched by political stability inside. What is the scenario politically in China that could really reset the deck on all of this borrowing and the idea of the China engine making everything work out with its 10% growth, et cetera?
Right. Well, I think we're already seeing that the engine is beginning to stall. And there's probably nothing more frightening to the Chinese leadership than that. Because, of course, the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party has been premised primarily on this belief that they will continue to grow the economy and continue to provide, a better and better livelihood for future generations of Chinese. But even before we precipitated the global financial crisis, China had already lost 2/3 of the value of its stock market. You were already starting to see factories slowing production, tens of thousands of people being laid off in China. Again, this is before we hit this global financial crisis.
Wow. Do you think the Chinese can continue to finance their extraordinary investments in defense spending in terms of upgrades of weapons and the maintenance of one of the largest armies in the world?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that, you know, Chinese defense spending, by our own estimates — they don't provide a transparent defense budget — but by their own estimates, is only about a quarter of ours. So they still lag far behind the United States. But I don't see any indication that the slowdown in the Chinese economy is changing their priority on defense. I expect that that will continue because they place a high priority on national security.
Finally, let's dream a little bit here. What is the chance that the U.S. and China, in a transformed relationship, could actually use their mutual power in a 21st century global community and end something like the Korean conflict and finally get rid of the DMZ and actually make that whole thing go away?
Well, I think we've seen progress, for example, on that issue. Certainly, China's been willing to host the talks. But I think it's important to remember that the end goal for both China and the United States may not be exactly the same, meaning the United States would be happy to see the North Korean regime fall and a united Korea. China's not quite at that point. What it wants is stability. So I think until one of us changes our end state for that particular conflict, I'm not sure we're going to make much more progress.
Well, we made a lot of progress talking about China. Thanks for coming in. Liz Economy is the Star Senior Fellow and Director of Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And now we get some headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The Iraqi parliament has delayed voting on a security pact until tomorrow. If they approve the plan, American troops could stay in the country until 2011. Intense negotiations delayed the vote. The Shia-dominated parliament has worked to make concessions to get more Sunni support. President-elect Barack Obama is scheduled to announce his security team next week. That's widely reported to include current Defense Secretary Robert Gates. He'll be the first Pentagon head held over by a president of a different party. In a press conference yesterday, the president-elect talked about his financial priorities.
In these challenging times, when we're facing both rising deficits and a shrinking economy, budget reform is not an option. It's a necessity.
And today, Austin Goolsbee and Paul Volcker have been added to the president-elect's economic panel. China has announced an interest rate cut of just over 1%, four times as much as other recent cuts, and the biggest reduction in more than 10 years. The move brings the rate down to 5.58%, and it comes as the Chinese leadership struggles with a slowing economy and rising labor unrest. Zimbabwe has rejected calls for it to declare a state of emergency over a cholera outbreak that has killed hundreds of people. The country says the situation is under control, and President Mugabe blamed the outbreak on Western sanctions against the West. Cancer diagnoses have dropped. That's according to a new report by leading cancer researchers. The number of deaths from cancer have been declining as well, and the decrease is mainly because of a reduction in deaths from certain forms of cancer, including prostate, lung, and breast cancer.
It was a big positive news story, I suppose.
It is.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Wall Street is open. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P are down more than 1% in the early going. A lot can change between now and the end of the day. A lot of hatred this morning from all of you, hating holiday food, hating language, hating pumpkin pie, sticky cranberries, and some of you combined both.
Veggies. When did it become so difficult to say vegetables that everything is now veggie? And if you don't say veggie, then you're not hip, and you're not green, and you're not with it. And so obviously, we're talking about very old vegetables. So that's one. And the other one is suffice it to say, which is a completely incorrect use of the word.
Thank you. Just settle down. It's going to be fine. Tell us what food you wish were gone before it even made it to your holiday table at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org, or, you know, what phrase you want eliminated from the English language. Lots of response from all of you. And as we approach Thanksgiving, it's one of the busiest travel weekends of the year, of course, and the airlines are an institution everyone loves to hate. And the angst and pain left over from the serious delays and the headlines about the declining airline industry during the fuel spikes and problems this summer have abated a bit. And so we wanted to check in with Scott McCartney, who writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal on the state of the airlines this holiday weekend and thinking about Christmas. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, John.
It seemed like there was only bad news for the airlines this summer, and a lot of it was related to fuel costs, reducing services, increasing fees. What's going on if you're on your way to the airport this morning?
Well, fuel costs are down. That's good for the airlines. Traffic's down. That's not so good for the airlines. And I think a little relief for holiday travelers. But the fees are still there. I think some people who don't travel frequently are going to head to the airport and be surprised that it really is a different travel world out there.
And we're talking about luggage fees, extra bag fees, and you're paying cash for almost everything you get on the plane, even including the nuts and crackers.
Yeah, that's right. If you want any kind of food on board, you pay for that. The baggage fees are the big thing. Most of the major airlines are charging $15 each way to check one bag, $25 each way to check two bags. So you show up at the airport with two bags, and you're looking at another $80 on top of your ticket.
A couple of passenger-friendly trends, however, relate to the reduction in traffic. We've also seen some airlines actually go away since the summer. Is the reduced traffic, maybe it's a sobering economic reality for the airlines, but for passengers, does it make rational sense given that the infrastructure seemed to be really pushed beyond the limit this summer?
Yeah, I think so. I think this summer, and more so the previous summer, we had really maxed out on the capacity of the system. The capacity needs to increase when the economy rebounds. We're going to be in the same world of hurt in terms of air travel. But airlines have taken about 10% of their domestic flights out of the skies. That reduces congestion at airports. It makes the lines at security check-in a little bit shorter. It makes it a little bit easier to check your bag. It just generally takes some of the strain off the system. And so in that sense, it's a good thing. It's interesting. The airlines took the capacity out because of high fuel prices, but their timing ended up really good this time. The fuel prices came down, but then the economy tanked. And so they were actually reducing capacity just as demand was really dropping off. And for a change, they got it right this time.
Well, then perhaps this is an opportunity for the new administration, for Barack Obama, to name a Secretary of Transportation or formulate a policy that's going to really take advantage of the situation and improve things for the long term. What's your recommendation?
Oh, I think that's crucial. I wrote a column on Election Day as sort of a letter to the next president, whoever that would be. And I think transportation is an area where this clearly is the time to make major improvements. It's a lot like infrastructure on the roads. It's easier to rebuild the bridge when there's less traffic. It's easier to expand capacity of airports, to install modern air traffic control equipment and all when some of the strain is out of the system. And I think this is an area where a new administration really can improve people's lives quite quickly. I think we would all like to see improvement at TSA checkpoints. And there are things they can do quickly to say, hey, there's a different game in town, and we're going to make it a little bit better for you.
And I heard a report that maybe the restrictions on liquids is probably going to go away. That might be something to look forward to next year. Finally, if we're paying more fees for bags, are the airlines doing better financially, and who's in the best shape?
Given recession is never good for airlines, compared to some other industries around here, the airlines are actually doing okay, and they're not in Washington begging for bailouts. In terms of who's in the best shape, Southwest Airlines is the airline that has been most profitable, that has the most capital, that really is well-positioned. in terms of being the strongest.
So that hasn't changed. Scott McCartney, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Good to be with you.
Scott McCartney is travel editor for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us on the phone from Dallas.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away.
If you consider flying this holiday weekend with Femi Oke, who has the headlines.
Fasten your seatbelts, ladies and gentlemen. The time is 22 minutes to the top of the hour. Bad news for you, I'm afraid. The Dow is down around about 140, 150 points so far. And American markets are closed tomorrow for the Thanksgiving holiday. The Wednesday before Thanksgiving is usually the busiest travel day of the year, but AAA says they're expecting about 400,000 fewer cars this year. That's a 1.5% drop from last year. President-elect Barack Obama is being particular about where his inauguration funding comes from. He's decided not to take money from corporations, lobbyists, or non-US citizens. He also won't accept individual contributions larger than $50,000, and there were caps on President Bush's inauguration donations as well, but they were much higher, $250,000 for individuals.
So is that going to cut into the number of shrimp that they have on hand, or how's that going to
work? It depends how many people donate, doesn't it?
It's an investigation that you should
might have to pool our funds.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll get on to that. Maybe not. Jamaica's parliament has voted to keep the death penalty. The country hasn't had an execution in 20 years, and the country's high murder rate motivated the decision. There have been more than 1,200 murders this year so far on the small island nation. Political talks between Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai continued for the second day. They're meeting in South Africa with mediation from the country's former president, Thabo Mbeki. Mr. Mbeki says negotiations have been, I'm going to quote him here, the same as ever, forward and backwards, sideways and around, end of quote.
Yeah, I think there's so not much progress
one
there.
Step forward and 20 back, perhaps. It's a nice way of putting it. But they're continuing. They have to go on. The original power-sharing deal was signed at the beginning of September, and they're still trying to work out who's going to have what cabinet posts and who has what department, etc., etc., and so it goes on. So how would you like freeze-dried turkey for your Thanksgiving dinner? That's what the astronauts up on Endeavour are having.
Oh, yes. Great. I wonder what they would want to reject. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Adora Udoji is away. Well, we saw a story this week that we just couldn't resist, and it was our reason to bring Trip Mickle, who's a staff writer for Sports Business Journal, here into the studio. Thanks for joining us, Trip.
Thank you for having me.
So Tiger Woods, his golf game doesn't seem to be deteriorating in any way, got a call from General Motors this week, and it wasn't a good call. Apparently they want to cancel his sponsorship contract with Buick. Why?
Well, I mean, the contract's up. At this point in time, it's tough to justify for GM spending $7 million, and it's a high-profile relationship, so they can kind of walk away from that sponsorship, get a ton of press for it. It's only $7 million, but it shows that they're cutting some fat from their budget.
So $7 million doesn't go to Tiger, and he says that he wants to spend more time with his family because he's expecting his second child, so it's okay with him.
Yeah, and it's okay with him because he's Tiger Woods. He's going to pick up another sponsor on his golf bag. It's not going to be a problem for Tiger at all. But for GM, it's a way to kind of cut some fat and get some attention for it.
And the auto industries are enormous contributors to sports sponsorship deals, whether we're talking about athletes or networks or the NFL or NASCAR. I'm wondering if this really is a sign that the sponsorship arrangement, the traditional business model, is in some jeopardy in this economic climate.
Well, we started the year, we had a conference, I guess, about the midway point through the year, and a lot of executives were saying sports is recession proof. Everybody's changed their mind.
Really?
They're beginning to feel the impact of it. Anybody who's making sponsorships, trying to cut sponsorship deals right now, is being told, hey, listen, we're not ready. We haven't finalized our budget. We're not spending more. It's causing some pain, and some people are realizing that the whole recession-proof mantra that they were kind of chanting earlier this year is just not holding true.
And it is real pain because the General Motors executives that talked regretfully about canceling the Tiger Woods deal said that something like 75% of the purchasers of the Buick SUV purchased it because of Tiger. It was something on that order.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Buick. You look at what it was like as a brand before Tiger, and it just didn't have a whole lot of youth to it. It was the kind of car, and
my grandfather.
Yeah,
had a,
exactly.
Had a Buick, yes.
Yeah, and Tiger infused some youthful energy into it, and probably drove a decent amount of sales for him.
How's NASCAR doing? It seems like they're only about sponsorships. I can barely see the car underneath all the labels.
Yeah. They're beginning to feel some pain. We saw Chip Ganassi Racing and Dale Earnhardt Racing merge this week to kind of, you know, create some efficiencies and cut some costs, and you also have seen GM pull out of two sponsorship deals at tracks in Bristol and New Hampshire. So it's coming.
The Viagra revenue stream is still going pretty strong there for the NASCAR.
Although pharmaceuticals is going to be challenged as well. Johnson & Johnson just pulled out of just decided not to extend its relationship with the Olympics because the pharmaceutical industry is supposed to be hit by kind of a $10 billion drawback in spending next year.
Wow. Well, I didn't even thought about the Olympics. Of course, the Olympics are tremendously dependent upon sponsorship deals. Well, the Tiger Wolf Golf Games at least is not threatened, and he's able to sort of spend a little more time healing up for the next tournaments next year.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's hope that knee gets ready, and he's ready to play. They need him back out there.
Well, they need him at the PGA more than Buick needs him, apparently. Trip Mickle, thanks so much for joining us. Trip Mickle is a staff writer for the Sports Business Journal, joining us here in the studio talking about sponsorship woes for the sports industry. No longer recession-proof. Thanks, Trip.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone, and we begin with headlines from Femi Okay.
Thank you very much. We have some new economic data in this morning. The number of people who applied for unemployment benefits fell to 529,000. And that's good news because it's a bigger drop in unemployment than analysts expected, down from last week's 16-year high. President-elect Obama will hold his third press conference in almost as many days on the financial crisis. He's expected to announce a new economic advisory board, including the former Fed chief Paul Volcker and Austin Goolsbee, staff director of the new economic panel. The Iraqi parliament has delayed voting on a security pact until tomorrow. If they approve the plan, American troops could stay in the country until 2011. And thousands of travellers are stranded in the Bangkok airport. Anti-government protesters have taken it over. The Thai commander says that the government should call a new election to end the political crisis. And flights were cancelled when the demonstrators stormed the airport yesterday. That's a look at some headlines making news for you this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So about 30 years ago, there was an almost unimaginable moment of history and tragedy in San Francisco.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh.
The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
You may recognize the voice there. That's now Senator Dianne Feinstein. Then she was president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, announcing at City Hall the shootings of Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk. Dan White made history when he assassinated Harvey Milk, the first openly gay man elected to office in San Francisco. 30 years have passed, as I said, and Hollywood is marking Milk's legacy politically on the silver screen in a new biopic movie. But to talk about the political significance of Harvey Milk, and the reviews of the movie have been pretty positive, we wanted to focus on some friends and people who worked with Harvey Milk and understand the politics that it took to accomplish what he accomplished. Joining us now is Carol Ruth Silver. She's a former member of San Francisco's Board of Supervisors and a good friend of Harvey Milk. Carol, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh,
you're very welcome. Good morning.
And good morning. And here in the studio with me is New York State Senator Tom Duane, a gay activist here in New York, very familiar with the Harvey Milk story and with the political significance of what happened 30 years ago and carrying that forward today. Tom, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Harvey Milk was the representative of a group, a constituency, a so-called special interest in San Francisco, who used his political savvy to really become a very powerful force in San Francisco. But he's more than just a representative of a particular special interest group, wouldn't you say?
Oh, a great deal more. And it's not exactly correct to say he was a representative of the gay constituency. He represented a district which had gay people and straight people and brown people and black people and old people and young people. And Harvey represented them all.
And we're going to use the voice of Sean Penn to evoke Harvey Milk. I mean, that's all that we can do at this point. But let's get a listen to the Long Island twang that Harvey Milk was known to deliver in his impassioned speeches. Here's Sean Penn speaking, though, from the trailer of the movie Milk.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you. On the Declaration of Independence, it is written, men are created equal. No matter how hard you try, you can never erase those words. That is what America is!
Sean Penn, an excerpt from the movie Milk, playing Harvey Milk from Long Island. Carol Ruth Silver, in Harvey Milk's political legacy, I mean, what he did was kind of mobilize a coalition in urban politics that really is reminiscent of a time that no longer exists in American urban politics. I mean, he was a wheeler and dealer way beyond simply being a gay rights activist.
I think that is true. He was the first one to reach out to, as a gay politician, to reach out to the other minor constituencies like Asians and in San Francisco in particular, the Teamsters. The foundation of his political might in San Francisco was a deal that he made with Alan Baird, the Teamster leader, over a boycott of Coors Beer. The Teamsters wanted to get Coors Beer out because they were non-union, and Harvey offered them the gay bars. They came to Harvey, actually.
Wow.
But he said, if you will allow gays to be truck drivers, to join the Teamsters, I'll organize all the gays in this area, and we will get Coors out of the bars. And they did, and Coors failed. Coors fell and gave the union what they wanted.
Hardball politics. Senator Tom Duane here in the studio in New York. What did Harvey Milk accomplish? I mean, I'm reminded of the defeat of Proposition 6, which was the old Anita Bryant-inspired measure in California, ballot measure to ban gays from teaching in the state of California. Harvey Milk took that on directly and won.
He was a great example of how you could, as Carol has said, organize not just the gay community, but really organize a lot of people to join together. So even out in California, when you saw this Prop 8 battle, it wasn't just the gay and lesbian community fighting to stop that proposition. It was also unions, and even Governor Schwarzenegger said he was opposed to it.
To remind people, Proposition 8, of course, is the proposition measure that passed this election, which banned same-sex marriage in California.
Yes, and I think that the model that he set up is one that most of us in politics who are gay or lesbian have followed, that we can't do it alone. There is no district that's predominantly or exclusively gay. We always have to join with other people. You can never get elected or win any ideological battles unless you join with other groups.
What do you think the political message from Harvey Milk's legacy is for people today thinking about the transition of the new Obama administration, Tom.
Keep fighting, even though I think the vast majority of the LGBT community, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, was very excited at Barack Obama's election for a whole host of reasons. It doesn't mean that the gay civil rights movement is by any means over. We're going to have some setbacks, but we have to keep fighting. And it's better to be with a friendly administration and fighting, but we still have to fight for ourselves.
Carol Ruth Silver, what's the lesson do you think Americans broadly should draw politically from the life and accomplishments of Harvey Milk, the late Harvey Milk?
I think Tom suggested it well, that that American politics is always coalition politics. There are always compromises to be made, and there's no point in being totally ideologically pure. You don't get anywhere that way. But in the movie, the movie has a number of slogans for Harvey Milk, which Harvey Milk delivers, but the one that is real, the one that the real Harvey Milk delivered time and time again, was out of the closet. His message to every gay person in, and this was, this began in the Anita Bryant fight, where, as is portrayed in the movie, he said, "There is no way that on a statewide initiative we, the gay community, is going to win this fight unless we have all these coalitions. So we have to come out. We have to say to our friend, our neighbor, our lawyer, our doctor, we have to say, I am the person that you are afraid of. I am lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender. I am the person that you have had as a friend, have had as a relative, have had as a son or a daughter. Don't be afraid of me. Vote against this initiative."
Well, Carol Ruth Silver, I mean, he gave his life, Harvey Milk did, for that out of the closet, and that was 12 years before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We've backslid,
right,
I think. Carol Ruth Silver, thanks so much for joining us from San Francisco. And Senator Tom Duane, do you have a last word?
Just the most powerful weapon in the arsenal that the LGBT community has is coming out.
Tom Duane, New York State Senator, thank you for that conversation. Carol Ruth Silver, former member of San Francisco's Board of Supervisors and a good friend of Harvey Milk. The movie Milk opens in theaters this weekend. And, you know, you got your Thanksgiving food you won't touch and words you just don't want to say year after year.
I think we should take the turkey away from Thanksgiving dinner because it's powerfully unhealthy. And the turkeys that you eat for Thanksgiving bear no resemblance to an actual wild turkey, because they're so oversized and pumped full of steroids and hormones and antibiotics. And next, the overused words, I'd like to get rid of going forward, proactive, frankly, and at the end of the day. Thank you. Love the show.
You know, I figured proactive was going to come in there eventually. Casseroles, grim dishes made with the quivering contents of a can of cream of mushroom soup. Get rid of those, says Jonathan. We want to hear what foods you're going to run away from because it's Thanksgiving tomorrow. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.